We are dealing with Moses, and some that haven't been with us through this study. We're actually studying various men in the Bible and looking at the lives that they lived. Of course, Moses was a great man. He's the one that we're studying at this time. It's kind of hard to separate sometimes the person that we're studying from the text where we find their life. We dealt with Abraham and Joseph, and so, of course, the book of Genesis. Now with Moses, we're dealing with the book of Exodus. It almost, in some ways, feels like a study of the book of Exodus, but we're really focusing in on Moses. And so let's remind ourselves, Moses was, as I said a moment ago, a great, great man in many ways, but he was just a man. And so just like the rest of us, he had his own personality and different characteristics, some good, some bad, but just an interesting man. He had really an interesting background, as we have seen. We don't know, we can't say much about the earliest years of Moses. As the book of Genesis opened up, he was just, of course, an infant. But, of course, he very quickly in the biblical text, we find him as the son of Pharaoh's daughter and accomplishing really great things for Egypt. You remember that Stephen tells us that he was instructed in all the wisdom of Egypt, and that he was a man of mighty words and deeds. And so we don't know what all that entails. Josephus, for one, tells us that he actually fought some battles for Egypt. Whether that is can be verified or not, I sort of doubt. But those deeds were mighty in some form or fashion. So I wish we had more insight into those years of Moses, but of course we don't. But at that point, he was brash, bold, confident. But one of the things that Moses never did was forget who he was and who his people were. So you recall that he had a desire to visit his brethren, and he went out and he saw an Egyptian mistreating one of his brothers, and he sort of overreacted and he killed the Egyptian. So at the age of 40, then he was forced to flee Egypt. He ended up for another 40 years in the desert of Midian and living an isolated kind of life simply as a shepherd. And it appears that during those years, he kind of lost some of his confidence, and he was no longer nearly as brash and bold. And so when the time came and God appeared to him in the burning bush and called him, of course, to emancipate his people, that you recall he hesitated with that. In fact, started making one excuse after another not to do it. He wanted God to find someone else for that job. But eventually he agreed to do that. And we see a change in Moses again. From the moment he decided that he was going to do what God wanted him to do and obey God, he showed a lot of courage every time he had to appear before Moses. He and Aaron, of course, went before Moses in the beginning and spoke the words of God, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh wouldn't do it. And so, of course, the plagues came, and we studied all through that. But Moses was faithful, appearing before Pharaoh over and over again, and boldly. He knew that God now was with him, and so he showed a great deal of courage. Of course, all of that ended with the 10th plague, and we saw that the devastating death of all of the firstborn of Egypt. And so finally, the spirits of Pharaoh and his people were broken, and now they demanded that Moses and the people leave Egypt. And so they left, and that's about where we are now at the Exodus. And so we see finally the Israelites, after 430 years of bondage, they are being set free. And so the year is probably around 1447 or 46 B.C., unless you take what they call the late date of the Exodus, be a couple hundred years later. It more in the 1200 period. And there's more people than you might think who take that late date In order to do that, though, you have to ignore certain Bible text, or at least say that they're figurative or symbolic. And that's in the passages under consideration. Passages like 1 Kings chapter 6 at verse 1, we have a passage there where it tells us that Solomon, in his fourth year, that he began building the house of God. He began reigning in 971 B.C., so that would be about 967 B.C. And the same text tells us that all of that took place 480 years after the Exodus, which then you just do the math, and that would put you at about 1447 or 46, right in that area, depending upon what time of year and everything things happen. But that would be about the date. So that's where we are with the Exodus. And that's what we're, again, reading, studying at this particular time. So the people leave Egypt. And remember, again, getting back to Moses and kind of figuring out what kind of man he was. You know, Moses was like the rest of us. He evolved. And now we see him in the role of leadership, really, in a great way. We know that it is, at the end of the day, God who leads the people out of Egypt and even through the wilderness and all of that. But so far as the earthly leader goes, Moses is the man. And you can just imagine what a difficult job that would be. Like, we just kind of read it casually. Like a lot of places in the biblical narrative, doesn't go into great detail about certain things. I'm often, you know, minded of even things like the crucifixion of Christ. You know, how it just says they took him and they crucified him. And that's about it. But we know that there's a whole lot more involved in that than just those few words. And so with the Exodus, we just read, you know, they finally, again, after those 400 years, left Egypt. Well, we're talking about over 2 million people. Like, you know, organizing 2 million people plus to go anywhere would be a great accomplishment. And as I've said before, there would have been dietary problems. They had to leave Egypt very quickly, you recall. So they didn't have really any provisions at all, and except they had the unleavened cakes left over from the dough from Passover, all that. But had very, you know, that would be an issue for 2 million people traveling someplace. Sanitary issues, organizational issues, all of that would be challenging. And the one leading the way is Moses. What does that say about the leadership of Moses? He certainly demonstrated great skill with regard to that. So here we are. They leave Ramesses and they go to Succoth. And we find in chapter 13, again, we'll not get into all the details of it in chapter 13, since this is not technically a study of Exodus itself. But in chapter 13, we see more information about the Passover and some extra information about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. See those, some of those details in chapter 13. We see the consecration of the firstborn. So God sets forth a law where the Israelites from here on, they're to give him their firstborn of all the man and beast. Why do you think God would do that? Why would God have them consecrate the firstborn? Have any idea? Come on. What do you think? Because what? Right. He had spared them. And, you know, he killed all the firstborn of the Egyptian, but none of the Israelites' firstborn. And so now he's commanding them to give him their firstborn. They were to redeem them. The cost was 5 shekels. And all of that lasted. It actually didn't continue. The Levites would eventually take the place of the firstborn. And so God said, the Levites will be mine. And we know how that history went. But some of that information is given to us here in Exodus chapter 13. And that's when they were at Succoth. And then they moved from there to Etham. And so, they're beginning their exodus. And then we come to chapter 14. And in chapter 14, there's a surprising turn and how they are leaving Egypt. It says at verse 1, "Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea." Now, the interesting thing about this is, and I know I just spent some time talking about Moses was the earthly leader, but who really is leading them? It is God leading them. Look at and back in chapter 13, verse 17 says, "When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines." So God is the one who's actually leading them. And if we continue reading there in chapter 13, we have the well-known information. He led them by way of the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, cloud by day, fire by night. But God is leading them. But now he leads them in an unexpected direction. Like the normal way to leave Egypt and go to Canaan would be the northern route that would take you along the coast of the Mediterranean. And there were natural routes there that everyone traveled. And yet, instead, God leads them south. And that would have been much tougher terrain and a long way around to get to Canaan. And why did he do that? Well, it says here, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, "Lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt." So on that route, on the northern route, there were Philistine fortifications, and God knew that they would probably get into some skirmishes with the Philistines, and they weren't really ready for that. Freshly after leaving Egypt, and the Exodus just beginning, you know, there were a lot of them, but they weren't really ready for war and that sort of thing. And so that's the obvious reason, I might say the outward reason of why they didn't go that route. But there has to be something more to it. Like the text and what I just read is 100% true. This is why God did it. But there had to be a different reason. Like, do you think God was afraid of the Philistine fortifications there? You think God could have handled that maybe? If he wanted to. But instead, he takes them, and the route that he takes them, these places, we can't be sure where all of these places are. If you look on a map, I think you'll see, it really just depends on what map you have. I have at least one map that has all three of these, Pi-hahiroth and Migdol and Baal Zephon. I have at least one map that has them on it. But most maps don't even have most of these cities or areas on them. And even the maps that do, you could tell that, like with Etham, I have a couple of different maps that have Etham in two totally different places. And whenever you see that on a biblical map, you know that the people involved in the geography are kind of guessing. Because there's some places we just can't be sure of exactly where they are. But what some of the scholars who are experts in the geography of this area would tell you is that this place, first of all, they think this Migdol was some kind of military fortress. And this Baal Zephon, we're told, is kind of like a cul-de-sac. It was, you know, a place that once you got in there, you know, it's kind of, you know, one way in, one way out situation. And so there were natural boundaries there that you can't necessarily see when you're looking down onto a map, but you'd kind of be trapped in there. Now, who's leading them? You think God knew the area? Of course he did. It's like he's purposely leading them into a situation where they could find themselves in a predicament. And this is exactly what happens. We find in chapter 14, Israel in a predicament. You ever been in a predicament? It's funny how we come up with, when we think about being in trouble, we come up with all kind of ways of saying that. Like, you're between a rock in a hard place. Or you're in a pinch. Or you're in a corner. Or against a wall. That sort of thing. Sometimes we say you're in a pickle. You ever been in a pickle? I don't know where these things come from. I guess, you know, there's a baseball. Some of you sport fans of baseball. Isn't that what they call running between the bases or whatever? Isn't there a game? Isn't that called pickle? I'm thinking of something out. That's called pickle? You said yes, Matt, so it must be. But anyway, you know, it's a predicament. And the Israelites, they're in a pickle. There's nowhere to go. Back into it, they're trapped. Because all of a sudden, they find themselves in this place, and they begin to hear the thunderous sounds of chariots and the horses coming. Because in the meantime, in all of this, Pharaoh's had a change of heart. And one of the reasons God probably led them in this particular way, because he knew how it would look. It would appear as if Israel is in a trap. And you, as you read some of the text there, you look down chapter 14 and at verse 3 says, "For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land, and the wilderness has shut them in." See, they're in that little area there, shut in. And you could see that, and Pharaoh could see that. And so once he realized that they were in that kind of situation, that they were shut in here, this particular area of the wilderness, he decides to pursue them. And the record says that God hardened his heart. But you notice it says that after Pharaoh decides, he comes up with this plan to recapture the Israelites. And if that's what he is planning to do, what do the Israelites think he's going to do? What do they think he's going to do? When they complained to Moses, what did they claim was going to happen to them? They were trapped. But he says, "What? You brought us out here to die in the wilderness?" So they believe that Pharaoh is now pursuing them again to kill them. And, you know, what Pharaoh was going to do, who knows? But one of the things that maybe they felt that way, because when they left Egypt, they did so defiantly, the ESV says. High-handedly. Like, you know, God had finally given them the victory. What did they do right before they left Egypt? Remember? They plundered the Egyptians. And, you know, got all their jewelry, things, silver, gold, all that. And then it says that they left defiantly. I think, is it in the book of Numbers, I can't remember the exact passage, maybe Numbers 33, where it said they left defiantly before all of Egypt. Like, gives you the strong impression there that you know, they left with an attitude, and Israel could see it. Well, now all of a sudden, they're in a pickle. They're in this trap, and here come the Egyptians. Can you just picture all that in your mind? Here you are. You're boldly and brashly leaving these people who've had you as their captors all of these years, all of your life. And you leave, and you do so with a defiant kind of attitude. Like, huh. They had the last laugh, but now they're trapped. And here they come. And in their mind, they're coming to kill them. And it's interesting. I mean, you want to talk about an army here. It says in chapter 14 that Pharaoh got the best chariots of Egypt. 600 chariots. That's a lot of chariots. I read somewhere where that the average chariot could hold up to five people in them. And because they had different people on the on any chariot, you'd have the travelers and you'd have the driver and you'd have a guard on there watching out. So you could hold, you know, several people on a chariot, an average chariot. Well, Pharaoh got 600 of his best chariots. And then the ESV says all the other chariots too of Egypt. So you're talking, there could have been upward, you know, 1,000 chariots led by horses coming right for the Egyptians. And so at verse 10 it says, when Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians went marching after them. And they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, it is because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness. Why have you done this to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. So they're convinced they're going to die. So you think of different ways you can respond when you find yourself in a predicament. And again, we all find ourselves in a pickle from time to time, don't we? How do you respond when your back is against the wall? When you're in a pinch, what do you do? How do you respond? They respond in a few different ways that's not so positive. The first thing they did was fear. And I know from a human standpoint, we look at this, and as you paint the picture, again, these are thunderous chariots coming over 600, many more than 600 coming after them, and the whole army. Don't forget, this is the most powerful army on earth. The Egyptian, this is the power here, and Pharaoh's coming after them with his whole army. 600 of his best chariots. And so from a human standpoint, yeah, we can understand why they're afraid. But what should have held back their fear? Right. Right. I mean, God is with them. And he has proven it. Like, they have lived through these plagues. And the glory of God. Remember, God performed all those plagues instead of just wiping out the Egyptians to reveal his glory for generations to come. But they're in it. They've seen firsthand the great power of God. And then, you know, most of what from plague 4 on, I believe it was, that it was only the Egyptians that were touched and nothing would happen to them. And they lived through all of that. And even now, they're being led by God by a pillar, a cloud, and a pillar of fire. I mean, clearly, God is with them. I don't know about you, and maybe it's easy for me to say as I stand before you in a comfortable building teaching a class far removed from this situation, but I don't know about you, but I'm thinking if God is leading me in such an overt and obvious way, a visible way even, a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire, I'm pretty confident. But they're full of fear. Enough to where they cry out. And one of the things that we can't do when we find ourselves in a predicament is you know, we have to continue in real life situations. Like, it's easy when life is going your way and everything is smooth, you're not having any problems, because we all find ourselves there as well. I mean, we all have difficulties arise in our life, but in all of our lives, there's smooth times. Maybe, you know, I've often said there's far more valleys in life than peaks, but we do have the peaks, don't we? And so, you know, it's easy to serve God when everything seems to be going all right. But what do you do when problems invade your life? When there's difficulties? When there's even things to be afraid of, when you get bad news from the doctor or whatever it might be, are you just overwhelmed with fear? We need to learn to trust God even in times of trouble. And this is kind of the first test for the nation of Israel. This is the first trial as a nation that they experience. And they're not doing too well. Right away, they fear as if God wasn't with them. And so that's a problem. And then another thing that we sometimes do when troubling times come, we get frustrated. And what do they do? After they cried to the Lord, what do they do next? They turn on Moses. Do we sometimes, when there's difficult in our life, just isn't going the way we should, do we ever play the blame game? And that's what they're doing. They immediately turn on Moses. And while we don't have all the details, obviously Moses has done a pretty good job leading them from Ramesses all the way to where they are now. Of course, they might be thinking, they're not doing such a great job. He led us into a trap. But he is doing a good job. And yet they immediately turn on him. Do you turn on leaders in the church? Do you, when things aren't going exactly the way you want them to go, turn on the elders? Get mad at the preacher? Not that the preacher's any kind of leader, but you get mad at the preacher when he preaches things and you don't like it. We got to be careful that we don't get overwhelmed with frustration and play the blame game when that's not the way you handle difficulties. But that's what they did. But notice the response of Moses. Moses, at verse 13, it says, "And Moses said to the people, 'Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again.'" And, you know, what a wonderful statement, a wonderful way he put that at just the right time. Oh, don't worry about these Egyptians. This is going to be the last time you ever see them. And so, his first message is, don't fear. That should be our message today. Get out of concordance. Look at how many times the Bible says to the people of God, fear not. And usually in those kind of passages, it is in times of difficulties. But I don't know how many times the Bible says to God's people, fear not. Fear not, O Israel. Who's the Israel of God today? We are the church. And those passages that tell the physical Jews, fear not, it's the same message for us. Fear paralyzes us, stops us from being what God wants us to do, stops us from serving God, stops us from preaching the gospel, stops us from standing for the truth, all because of fear. What is it that we fear? What stops us from doing the work of the Lord? Lack of faith. That was exactly their problem, and it's our problem too. When we allow anxiety and fear to overwhelm us to the point where we stop doing what God wants us to do, that can't be anything but a lack of faith. But what is it that we're afraid of? What is it that we're afraid of? Huh? Yeah, right. So we're afraid of man, really, aren't we? And that's right. We're not afraid that man's going to kill us, not in this country, but being rejected by man. We're paralyzed by that fear sometimes. Worried about what man's going to say, how they're going to view us. It paralyzes us, and we can't allow that to happen. A few hands. Let me get to Matt and then Autumn. Yeah, go ahead, Matt. Right. Yeah. Right. Right. That's a big thing of what he as they complain here, you know, they wish they'd never left Egypt. And going forward, we're going to find them saying on more than one occasion, wish we were back in Egypt. And to that, remember, Egypt is kind of a type of the world. Don't let the devil fool you into going back into the world. There's nothing there for you but sin and separation from God. But that's what the devil wants you to do. Autumn, yeah, go ahead. Right, that's exactly right. And remember, God led them here. I mean, there not only is he going to allow us to have trouble, there are times when God might lead us into a difficult situation, providentially. Like, that's what Hebrews, 13 is all about, the chastisement of the Lord. He you know, that's one of the ways that God chastises us, through his providential workings. Because he knows that difficult times can sharpen us, can help us. God doesn't want us to always be completely problem-free. Because he knows sometimes what we need is some trouble. Get us back on track. And here, he understands his people more than they understand themselves. He's training them, I believe. Like, this is a reason why, again, why didn't he just take that northern route? Well, because the Philistines, God could have handled those Philistines if he wanted to. He purposely led them to the Red Sea. One thing he's going to do, and the text states it, just like with the plagues, through the opening of the Red Sea, that's going to glorify his name some more. And the Egyptians are finally, they're going to know that he is the Lord, he is God. But it's also going to help these Israelites and their faith. They're getting a picture of themselves right now. And it's not a pretty picture right here at first. And as we go through life, we just need to understand that, you know, trouble, we don't want to look for trouble, certainly. But how are we going to respond? How are we going to handle difficult times when they come? We don't have time tonight, but there's all kind of passages, James chapter 1 and Romans chapter 5 and other passages that actually teach us that it's good to suffer, that it's good to go through trials, that it builds our character and leads to hope. And do you think God knows that? Of course he does. Of course he does. And so we need to understand God's not going to always take our problems completely away. He wants to see how we're going to deal with difficult times when they come. And so that is a powerful lesson, I think, through all of this. All right. Well, for the second bell rings here, verse 14 it says, "The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward." And what great advice. And by the way, you know, we have no idea. When he says, that seems kind of out of place. The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me?" When did Moses cry to God? That seems like we don't have record of that. He evidently went to God in prayer. But we don't have that petition. But here's the message to them. Go forward. And, I mean, obviously, what a test, even in saying that through Moses, to go forward. What's forward? The Red Sea. Like, what do you mean, go forward? Well, he's about to open up the way to them, as we all know. But what instruction, and what great instruction for us. We need to go forward. In fact, in times of trouble, that's how you defeat it. Not by ignoring it, not by shrieking back, but going forward. And with the help of God, realizing that God is with us, having faith and confidence in God going forward. There's all kind of applications we can make with regard to going forward. We need to go forward spiritually. We need to go forward in our Bible knowledge and growing, always going. That should be the direction that Christians are always traveling, forward. Not looking back, not standing still, being neutral as Christians, but going forward. Go forward. The last thing the devil wants is for us to go forward. And isn't it interesting, before the second bell rings here, that, you know, just the devil, how God defeats the devil over and over again. That last thing devil wants for us is to go forward. And he, you know, he loves the way things develop on the surface sometimes, and God always seems to defeat them. Even in these physical stories of the Old Testament, you can imagine with Pharaoh. Pharaoh probably thought, oh, I got these Israelites now. Who was he thinking? They're trapped. Well, who's really in a trap? who was trapping who? Right. I mean, this wasn't Pharaoh's. This was God's trap. He again is about to show his power and strength in an unbelievable way. When we think of the opening of the Red Sea, like, that is a story that almost everyone knows. And what great power was demonstrated by God. And so Pharaoh's thinking, and you know, oh boy, I got these Israelites right where I want them. Well, no, he was the one in the trap. And we see that playing out in our lives. Again, the devil thinks, he's constantly thinking that. What did he think when Jesus was on the cross? Gotcha. I'm the winner. But he was in God's trap. That worked out exactly. That was a part of the foreknowledge of God working out salvation for man. And we could give story after story. What did the Babylonians think when the three friends of Daniel were thrown into the furnace of fire? Gotcha. I didn't have anyone. So something to think about and learn from. We'll pick up there whenever I get back.